Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is CJ for the Science, Technology, and Society channel at the New Books Network. I'm here with Lucas Rickert on his book, Break On Through, Radical Psychiatry and the American Counterculture, out on MIT Press last year. Welcome, Luke.
Hi, thanks for inviting me to chat.
Absolutely. So before we get started to talk about your book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you get interested in this topic in the first place, and anything else relevant about your background?
Sure. Yeah. So it's always nice to share some ideas and work. So I appreciate you asking to have a conversation about this. I guess the most important thing that I suppose I want to say about myself is that, you know, it's been a weird and wild sort of trajectory, and it wasn't predetermined that I was going to write this book in any way. I began as a scholar of the pharmaceutical industry, actually. I was lucky enough to travel and study in Canada and Scotland and England. And what really got the journey of Break On Through kicked off was sort of one of those awesome aha moments in the archives where you're just sitting there and then your mind is totally blown by some documents that you just sort of come across. For me, that was in 2008, 2009, roughly. These documents were about radicals in mental health. The period was the 60s and the 70s, and these radicals self-identified as radicals. And so that's what led to me sort of writing Break On Through as really sort of a scholar of the U.S. pharmaceutical industry and other sort of drugs. And man, the lights just sort of went off. And I was thinking this could be a really exciting project. It could be a personal challenge. At the time, I didn't have a full-time tenure-track job. At the time, I was just finishing up my PhD, and so that was kind of like the genesis of this book, as sort of like the very end of my graduate studies. And so, you know, that was I guess over 10 years ago now when I started thinking about writing the project, and now here I get to talk to you about it for a little while.
That's wonderful. Absolutely. So one thing I wanted to talk about when it comes to your book is the interesting way that you detail all this history, because you have primarily a period that you're focusing on. And while it is about psychiatry, as the subtitle illustrates, it's also about American counterculture. It's about all these paradoxes and contradictions of this time. So could you tell us a bit about how you managed to sort of bring in these different elements? You know, so if we could just take, for example, the first chapter on disruptions, right, where you deal with several subtopics that are related to this overall change happening and how American society was thinking about psychiatry and mental health and things like this.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the jury's out, I suppose, on whether or not I managed it successfully or not, and managed to sort of bring everything together. What I wanted to do, Chad, was, I guess, offer a history of mental medicine from a slightly broader vantage point. You know, a lot of fascinating, important books have been written already when it comes to specific disease categories, whether or not it's depression or migraine or you know, a lot of great books have been written about interventions, therapeutic interventions like lobotomy, what have you. You know, it could be hydrotherapy, it could be the asylum system. And a lot of authors have done this very well. And so I suppose my approach was to be slightly more expansive and think about how these different ideas operated in sync, but then also departed from each other. And at the same time, what I wanted to bring into the conversation was a slightly, cultural approach. A lot of great work has been done strictly within the realm of biomedicine or through the sort of the lens of political and legislative history when it comes to mental medicine. So my thought was to address at least what I thought was a gap in I wanted to offer sort of cultural perspectives to sort of add to the conversation.
Absolutely. So before we get into any more details of the book, I was wondering if we could, unpack this term radical psychiatry a bit more. So looking back at some of the work of people that are brought up in your book, like Steiner and Lange and May, others, how might we define radical psychiatry, and how does it differ from anti-psychiatry discourses that, were around the same time period and continue today, including Scientology, another case that's brought up in your book?
Yeah, sure. I mean, really good questions, really tough questions. So thanks for nothing. I mean, what your question does, or questions, I suppose, do is point really to how complicated mental medicine was in the 60s and the 70s. And I don't want to suggest that it was uncomplicated in other eras. Right. No, in fact, I think it's always been a fairly complex admixture. But look, so radical psychiatry still exists in the APA, so it didn't go away. And, I've been in touch with members relatively recently, so it's not also like it just sort of disappeared either. What I wanted to do with Break On Through is sort of describe just how multifaceted the era really was. And so mental health knowledge practices were super contested. And that was within the APA, but it's the same outside of the APA too. So in answering your question about what is radical psychiatry, you come at it a couple different ways. Defining radical psychiatry is super thorny. So on the one hand, there's the sort of specific self-described radicals. So that's the radical caucus within the American Psychiatric Association. They called themselves a radical group, right? They gave themselves that label. They embraced that language, and they named a journal Radical Therapist. And then on the other hand, you have this mix of ideas and therapies and people that are operating outside the mainstream. So they're pushing against orthodox practice, they're rejecting pharmaceutical interventions, or they're fighting against involuntary hospitalization, or perhaps large mental hospitals altogether. And there's a whole long list of sort of ideas like this. But, these people or these ideas may not have been specifically radical. The idea was not embraced by these ideas. So, you mentioned Artie Lang, he didn't consider himself an anti-psychiatrist. And to my knowledge, in the documents I've looked at, he didn't really refer to himself as a radical either. You mentioned Claude Steiner, who was deeply involved in the Radical Caucus. He didn't refer to himself as an anti-psychiatrist. So, coming up with a strict definition of radical psychiatry leads down rabbit holes, but we just have to be cognizant, I think, of who actually chose to describe themselves as an anti-psychiatrist or as a radical, because that sort of that self-description matters vis-a-vis nomenclature or terms that we retrospectively place on people, if you sort of see what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I suppose what I was trying to get here was, you had a breakdown in your book, about different ways of looking at the psychiatrists at the time, sometimes through self-description. So some of them being more, radical in their treatments, some being radical in their philosophy. But the differences here between, say, reforming the discipline or completely changing it, or anti-psychiatry in the sense of completely removing it, right? So, I was wondering if you could maybe describe some of those differences, because I think it's important when we get to, say, some of the more what might be described as New Age treatments, which we'll get to. But some of the contradictions here in terms of treatment versus philosophy, I guess.
It's a great point. And so in the book, as you rightly point out, I list sort of the taxonomy of radicalization. And this is something that emerged from the Radical Caucus group itself and was one of the documents that I actually found when I was getting into the dusty and dirty archives. And this taxonomy sort of creates a list of measures, I guess, in different domains. And within these domains, what you have is a way of trying to understand degrees of radicalism within psychiatry. So again, as you rightly pointed out, at one end of the spectrum might be psychiatrists who were licensed, obviously, working within the APA, who felt it was important to who demolish the APA infrastructure altogether and move away from sort of an insurance-based for-profit medical model in the United States, whereas others who adopted the radical label felt that it was important, less radically, if you will, that, they move away from an asylum system, move away from the use of electroconvulsive therapy, and think more seriously about the adoption of community mental health centers. So I suppose what I'm just trying to underline is that there was a whole variance when it comes to what radicals actually felt and believed, which informed how they operated, not only with their colleagues in the APA, but how they interacted with patients, with patient consumers, how they operated within the medical marketplace more generally.
Yeah, and I think this is such an important history for just that point, right? I mean, I think that so much of these these like radical psychiatrists have often been painted as strictly anti-psychiatrists.
Correct.
And so there's actually a lot more nuance here. And that's particularly the case with the Radical Caucus, as you brought up. So we're talking about here, when we say APA, we are talking about the American Psychiatry Association. So how did this Radical Caucus come about? And you know, what sort of impact did they have on the profession insofar as we can talk about impact?
Yeah. So I guess the first thing I'd say is that the Radical Caucus was pretty small for the most part. I mean, I don't have exact figures for how many members there were. So it's just like one small subgroup of the American Psychiatric Association, which had over 10,000 members in the late 1960s. It could have been 11, 12,000 members. So, I mean, I don't want anyone to think necessarily that psychiatry as a whole in the U.S. was radicalized, because there were, you know, this is one group, one pocket, and, you know, very specific people that I'm talking about. But I think telling those stories is pretty important. You know, it's pretty vital to sort of unpack these ideas within mental medicine. So look, a lot was happening in 68, 69, which is really when the caucus sees its moment of formation. So, like, I don't have to tell you as a historian of this period or sociologist of this period in mental medicine, there's tons of debates, which I've already alluded to. But at the same time, you've got a lot of bubbling ferment with the rights revolution, the civil rights movement, women's rights, the rights of certain other groups, whether or not it was American Indians or homosexual groups in the United States. So, I mean, you're seeing this sort of like bubbling ferment around sort of certain countercultural ideas, changing ways of thinking about military intervention in Southeast Asia. And this, I make the case, directly informs the emergence of the Radical Caucus. That, you know, you're seeing that that these folks, they're pretty in tune with what's happening. They're pretty in tune with actually things that we're talking about right now in 2021, whether or not it's, you know, disenchantment and dislocation with our pandemic, or political divides, or poverty. I mean, they're thinking about violence and sexism, just like we are thinking about this in 2021. And sort of that kind of gives rise to this this group in the American Psychiatric Association.
Yeah, I think you on page 43 of your book, you say, in 1968, the radicals first coalesced as a group at the APA's annual meeting in Boston under the rubric Psychiatrists for Action on Racism in the Urban Crisis. And I think, you know, this idea of this idea of psychology and psychiatry today, just now tackling like structural racism, it's like, if we look back, actually they were saying a lot of the same things then, as you just said. So it's really interesting to make that comparison, because it does seem to be ongoing. And perhaps if more of this history would have been available sooner, you know, that maybe we wouldn't have to repeat it so much.
But, isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was wondering, cause you do bring up some of the issues around like the domestic sphere and women and feminism. So, yeah. What was also going on, in terms of thinking about, you know, mental medicine and gender at this time?
Sure. Yeah. So when you think about the Radical Caucus, it also, you can break it down even further, because there were sort of subgroups within this Radical Caucus that had their own specific ideas and agendas. Some involved the civil rights movement and the support of African Americans, and perhaps dealing with problems within urban areas that you referenced just then. But also there were members who cared very much about how feminism and women operated within the United States, and how psychiatry institutionalized maybe gender norms or the nuclear family, how psychiatry acted as a method of surveillance and a means to police women in the household and in, I guess, the United States more generally. So that might have been through, you know, remediation of behavior. It might have been through intervention with psychotropic medicines. So there were a lot of feminists and radicals who were saying that we needed to think seriously about the ways in which psychiatry weaponized and potentially harmed gender within society, and that there needed to be recasting and rethinking of what have been referred to as mother's little helpers, the ways in which women were hospitalized involuntarily, and which has been chronicled in several really excellent books. So, yeah, I guess just to answer your question, you know, race and gender were like really maybe not suddenly of interest in society, far from, because you're going through this rights revolution. But it seemed like they were rising to the fore with certain radicals in the APA, that they were, that some of these figures who I mentioned in the book really are pulling on these ideas and sort of suggesting that the APA needed to embrace the ideas of change, essentially.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I think that that, you know, it almost seems inevitable that they would professionally have to start dealing with what were issues outside the profession, right? That there'd be some pressure there. But there's also some pressure from within, as mentioned, to think about different treatments. So perhaps we can move on to some different treatments. One of them, one that I think would be interesting to talk about would be transactional analysis. So thinking about the work here of Eric Byrne and then who's the mentor then of Claude Steiner. So if we could maybe talk a little bit about them and what was sort of refreshing about this approach and what was maybe seen as radical, at least compared to other treatments at the time.
Yeah. So transactional analysis, as you pointed out, is created by Eric Byrne. He is sort of a Canadian American MD, trains in McGill, trains in California, and is sort of operating within that California context, which is, I suppose, kind of one of the themes of Break On Through as well, is sort of what's happening in California in mental medicine. Transactional analysis is one of these therapies that sort of is pressing up against the mainstream psychoanalysis and taking psychoanalytic techniques and maybe sort of reformulating them to a certain extent So Eric Byrne had a tortured relationship in San Francisco with the psychoanalytic community, which forced him to theorize differently about how individuals interacted with themselves, but also interacted with each other. Not to be too simple about the whole thing, but transactional analysis, when it was operationalized, soon found a pretty robust audience. He not only did Byrne sort of find a lot of mental health professionals in psychology and psychiatry gravitating towards him, but he also sold boatloads of books. Like, people just loved his books. And so it became, I wouldn't say faddish, but it certainly became very well-known transactional analysis in the United States and more generally. One of my favorite parts of the book, Chad, is sort of some of the tapes that I found that talk that basically illustrate the relationship between Eric Byrne, Claude Steiner, and some of the other transactional analysis. Byrne loved to smoke this pipe, and he would every week have people over to his really nice house and have a jam session where they talk through important cases. And there are lots of tapes of these that his budding historians or other researchers can get a hold of, that sort of showcase the sometimes tense back and forth, sometimes funny back and forth between the different transactional participants.
That sounds so fascinating. Yeah, I was really intrigued by that. I would love to hear those sometime.
I would have loved to have been there too, there and listen to what was going on. I mean, after these parties wrapped up and after they got through their case studies, Byrne would crank up the music and everyone would, have a dance party.
Yeah, this does sound very Californian. So I guess it's a good transition to then talk about some of these sort of new age therapy institutes, like the Esalen being the probably the most famous of them, most influential. So what sort of therapies were being offered there, and how might we see this influence sort of ongoing from this point in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, so the Esalen Institute is, started up in 63 or 62. I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head, but the Esalen was created in California, right? So, and what it did was, I suppose the underlying philosophy there was integrating sort of humanistic psychology in conjunction with Eastern philosophies, embracing holism and wellness, embracing personal transformation. And that had to do with not only mind, but also the body and the spirit. And Esalen was a place where transactional analysis was taught. So Eric Byrne was there and transactional analysis theory was used. But to your question, you had folks like the psychologist Carl Rogers was there, and he was teaching elements of the human potential movement, which included notions of existentialism and phenomenology. And then besides that, you had at Esalen, Gestalt theory was also offered to visitors at Esalen. So Gestalt comes from the German psychiatrist Fritz Perl. And so the idea here is placing a greater emphasis on sensation and perception, bodily awareness and emotion. And then thirdly, what else? You had Maslow. So it's Abraham, right? That's the first name?
Yes.
So Abraham Maslow taught the notion of self-actualization. So probably everyone listening to this podcast knows that he came up with the idea of the hierarchy of needs. And so he was offering lectures to everyone there. So Eslan, you know, it's a funny story. A lot of folks have written about Eslan, and I think it matters now if we want to connect this history to the present, because it's still kicking around. And you don't have to probably go much farther than thinking about the psychedelic renaissance in 2021 to think about that contemporary relevance. So, you know, some of the leading lights and the biggest intellectuals studying psychedelics right now are still going to the Eslan and sharing notions around personal transformation and perceptual changes associated with, you know, things like DMT and psilocybin and LSD. So, I mean, it's still there. It's, you know, I wouldn't say it, its fame has diminished really. It's still pushing certain new age therapies.
Yeah. So I think that now that we've talked a bit about some of these different approaches within the profession, some of these different treatments, perhaps it would make sense to talk about something that was brought up very briefly before, but about people from the outside, basically, or people who are less of a focus when it comes to the history of psychiatry, which is the voices of the patients themselves, of the consumers. So what can you tell us about some of these patient and consumer movements and organizations, you know, such as the Mental Patients Liberation Front or the Insane Liberation Front? You know, where and how did they emerge, and what effects did they maybe have on the psychiatric practice?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I generally agree that there's been too much of a focus on elites, if you will, you know, the doctors or the policymakers in the literature when it comes to history of psychology or mental medicine. So I generally agree with that. I think there has been some great work though.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking of people like Skull or Nancy Tomes or Hilary Marland. There. So, I mean, it's not like that totally hasn't been told. Some voices are there. You know, I guess I'd also say there's probably still a lot to learn, even though, you know, that those voices have been heard and made more audible in the literature. I think there's really quite a bit still to learn about the role of grassroots activism and the patient perspective. In the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, my period mostly, but then in lots of other historical periods too. So,
right.
You know, rather than get in the weeds about specific groups, maybe I'll just try and answer the question more broadly, if that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess when I was writing Break On Through, I thought it was really, really valuable to think about how patient movements worked with psychiatrists and psychologists, and then how sometimes they weren't able to, or how you know, medical practitioners or what have you were rejected by patient movements. So I tried to sort of underline that tension a little bit in the book, because that interaction between patient movements and healthcare providers, that's really complicated and really, I think, important moving forward too, for the training of mental health providers. So, I mean, I think there are a couple lessons maybe that I can pull very quickly from the book. One is that you can't really think of the patient movement as sort of like one monolithic group at all. That, I mean, that's just That's a recipe for disaster. So there are lots of different labels and various names, and lots of different agendas and lots of different ideas. So you already, we already talked about anti-psychiatry. And certainly a lot of patients use that label. Then there was, you know, mental health consumer. There's mad liberation. Some people called them survivors, called themselves survivors, psychiatric survivors. You know, other people said they were inmates. So I guess if people are writing about this, and I think they really, really should be writing about the patient perspective in the future, that was sort of one thing to underline from my perspective, is that nomenclature and motivation is really important when thinking about these groups and people. And, you know, besides that, I just find it like super amazing to research about patient movements. And that was one of the best things about the experience of writing the book, honestly, is getting to see how patients, you know, what kind of impulses actuated them, you know, how they were able to work with others or chose deliberately not to work with mental health professionals and why. And so I tell a couple of those stories in the book.
Yeah, no, it's a very fascinating history. And speaking of fascinating histories, you have another book, Strange Trips, fantastic book as well. In Strange Trips, you know, you do talk quite a bit about some of the tensions around drug policy and law and treatments. And so I was thinking perhaps here we can link to your one of your last chapters and break on through dealing with some of the drug treatments at the time and some of these tensions as well between you know, legality and illegality and why, you know, why these drug treatments were suddenly of such focus at this time.
Yeah. So where I'm coming from in that chapter, it's about substances in the 70s. Where I'm coming at, so the angle I'm taking, I suppose, is, you know, how does mental health knowledge get wrapped up in discussions of drugs? And then how do ideas around drugs inform mental health policy, right? So I see a real important back and forth between the regulation of things like MDMA, marijuana, LSD, and how people have access to proper therapies. So with LSD, you know, this is a substance that was identified in the 40s, late 30s, early 40s, and then was considered to be a viable treatment, an object of study, all the way up to the mid-1960s, late 1960s in the United States, when it was then placed on Schedule I. A lot of patients potentially lost the opportunity to be treated with this substance, which is, you know, problematic from proponents of psychedelic psychiatry. So that was one, you know, sort of one little anecdote in the book. With marijuana or cannabis, depending on what term you use, mental health professionals have debated cannabis for a long time. And it's one of those substances that creates camps. And what I try to do and break on through is illustrate that mental health professionals reified the notion that cannabis created psychosis, that it led to depravity and crime, that it led to all sorts of problems. But then on the other hand, you have certain radical psychiatrists and psychologists who were suggesting that, you know, like, let's tap the brakes here for a second. Maybe not all the evidence is in. Wouldn't it be clever if we thought through the evidence base here before we make statements about how marijuana actually causes mental health problems? So, you know, these are just a couple of ideas that sort of pop out in that chapter. And I think that it matters, obviously, nowadays, because there's real critique of the psychotherapeutic interventions that are available for people who are suffering from major depressive disorder or from post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're looking for alternatives to what's on the market. So that's why you're seeing the return of LSD. That's why we're seeing more and more studies for psilocybin and DMT. That's why we're seeing all this money being plowed into the psychedelic space. And we're seeing major investors supporting startup companies like never before. And more mental health professionals are being enlisted in this project.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's another one of those points, you know, in your history where it's like, well, is it really still history, right? It's still going on. And and sort of interesting to go back and see, you know, the kinds of debates that we're having then around the safety or around the medical uses, the medicinal uses of these drugs. Well, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you last couple questions. One about your book, since it's so enriching, there's so much in there. There's obviously a lot of topics that we didn't get to discuss. You know, if we had more time, I wish we could just talk all day about it. But were there any other highlights that you wanted to bring up? Were there any really surprising findings or anything else you wish to highlight about your book before we wrap up?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I'd like to talk long too. I'd talk longer, although, you know, it's one of those things where after a while I start boring myself. So I appreciate that. I don't want to bore you or anyone else. It's, you know, one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book in writing this history, I suppose, is being slightly experimental with the subject matter. I just want to sort of tip my hat to some of the great work that's out there already. At the same time, I wanted to make sure that in the future, new scholars are thinking holistically and through an interdisciplinary lens when it comes to mental medicine. It's in my view, it's vital that we're thinking along multiple intersecting channels and lines when we're trying to tell these important stories. That's, I suppose, that would be my tuppence worth for you and the audience, that, you know, sometimes it's not enough just to tell the legal and biomedical history. And sometimes you gotta insert some films and literature and music into the story.
Yeah, which also makes it, I mean, one, it makes it more, I think, interesting, but it also gives it this kind of nuance, you know, I mean, just to think of these professionals as only being influenced by other professionals when, like, they're part of culture too, right? Like they're being exposed to films and music as well. So it's really interesting, all this history. Before we wrap up, yeah, I wanted to ask, what are you working on now?
I'm at the final stages of a project, and I'm looking forward to the completion of it for sure. It's called Cannabis Global Histories. It's coming out, I guess, this year. So it's been a good 3 years in the making. And so the idea behind it is to, you know, tell the history of cannabis, discuss its policy, how it is operated within society, but way beyond just the United States or and I guess North America. So I wanted to try and tell it, tell that story of cannabis from South Africa, from the angle of the Middle East, from Iran and Palestine, and from loads of other places, just so we have a bigger, better, more holistic picture of cannabis as we move forward.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. Look forward to reading about that. Well, thanks again for joining us, and I hope everyone who listens checks out your book.
Thanks so much.